You are listening to the Arena Olympiad series, where we bring you highlights from Arena's programming to keep you company during the coverage of the Olympic Games in Paris, with interviews by Sean Rocks and myself, Kay Sheehy. On tonight's programme, we will bring you insights from the classical world. A production of George Frederick Handel's Julio Cesar, discussed by its director Tom Creed, conductor Nicholas McGeegan, and mezzo-soprano Sharon Carty. The outgoing chief conductor of the National Symphony Orchestra, Jaime Martin, brings us his insights into Verdi's Requiem. And the Allegria Quartet perform works of Grieg and Mendelssohn. But first, Sean Rocks explores the work of Vivaldi's L'Olympiade.
Well, after winning an Olivier Award for the production of Vivaldi's opera Bazige in 2021, Irish National Opera, with the Irish Baroque Orchestra, is returning to the Italian master for an opera called L'Olympiade. This work tells a story of power, of love, of deception, but all of it set in ancient Greece in and around the Olympic Games. But they're not fighting for gold, silver and bronze in these Olympics. Oh, no. These men, because it is two men who are competing, essentially, that we're interested in at any rate, are competing for a princess's hand in marriage. Here to tell us more is mezzo-soprano Alexandra Urquiola and Irish National Opera's artistic director, Fergus Shiel. This little dance of yours with Vivaldi has been going on for a number of years now, Fergus. Obviously, there's something that has attracted you to a man who, for the most part, if you say Vivaldi, people will say, oh yeah, some 600 and whatever concertos.
Violin concertos.
Same concerto 600 times, whatever, you know. But they'll think of him in terms of instrumental music. They won't think of him in terms of operatic music.
I know, and it must be the most influential CD that I ever bought, which was Cecilia Bartoli's album of Vivaldi arias, which I got, you know, 20 years ago when it came out new, and I just absolutely fell in love with this music because I'd never heard anything quite like it. It's so fresh, it's so beautiful. Lots of it is very virtuosic and difficult, and he treats the human voice like it's a violin. And I at the time I was playing the violin a little bit myself, and I thought, wow, this is incredible. You know, it sounds just like all these concertos I'm trying to play. I fell in love with the music. So when it came to, you know, running Irish National Opera and having the opportunity to program some Baroque operas. And I know, a lot of people know Handel's operas. They're very famous in terms of the Baroque repertoire. But I just thought it would be interesting to go down a route that we don't know so much about.
And I think he was, in his day, yes, of course, the instrumental music was important, but his operas were huge hits in their day.
Oh, they were, absolutely. And he trotted them out. He wrote over 90 operas, you know, which is a huge output.
Nearly as many as he did concertos.
A lot of them are lost, unfortunately. Yeah. So it was only about 20 or 30, which still we have the scores and the materials and we can perform. So we've done, this is our third one. So there's still plenty more now to choose from.
A few more to go. And Alexander, the music of Vivaldi, how quickly did it become part of your repertoire? Fergus talking there about if you could just behave like a violin, please, that'd be fine, which has four strings and a bow and 10 fingers. A little bit different from the human voice.
Yeah.
How demanding a composer is he for voice, Vivaldi?
That's a great question. I think that, first of all, thank you for having me here with you today. I think that Vivaldi actually, he was the music director of a girls' conservatory in Venice during the time, and he wrote a lot for those girls. And so he got to know their voices very, very well, and actually he wrote a lot for the mezzo-soprano, which is my voice type. So, you know, I'm partial to Vivaldi and his preferences as well. But I think that, you know, just like Fergus was saying, he wrote as if the voice was an extension of his arm, as if it was its own instrument, and being an extension of the body, I think that he really got to know the human voice very, very well. And you'll hear it now. There are some phrases that maybe are a bit virtuosic. Maybe he wasn't thinking of the demands of breath control for a singer.
You don't need a breath for a big long phrase on the violin,
exactly.
Let's face it.
Exactly. There are sometimes a full page without him writing a breath for us. But other than those challenges, I think that he really knew the human voice well, and I'm lucky to sing it.
So apart from that, it's really easy.
Yeah, apart from that, please.
He was also a church musician. He was a priest, of course, himself.
So there were sacred music.
Yeah, he wrote a lot of sacred music also. So he was used to writing for the voice as well as the violin.
I noticed, I was looking up something today about the story here. I did put the challenge to you, Fergus, before we came to air. You have 30 seconds to summarise the plot of L'Olympiade. But you possibly can give us a very precise and concise version
of it. Yeah, I can do my best. It is a little bit convoluted, but it centres around the Olympic Games. We don't actually see any of the games on stage during the opera, but the two guys who are...
Pals.
Who are pals, who we meet at the beginning, they're both... one of them wants to compete in the Olympic Games because he wants to win the prize of Princess Aristea, who is Alexandra.
Alexandra's character, yeah.
But he knows he's not a good enough athlete, so he gets his mate to, will you compete for me and win this girl for me? And he had previously saved his friend's life, so his friend sort of owed him a favour. So he said, sure, I'll do that. But they don't realise that his friend is already in love with Alexandra. So that in the end, they both sort of compete for the same woman.
Yeah.
There's another rejected woman in the background, yes. She's not happy at all.
Yeah.
But it turns out, of course, that one of the boys happens to be, as the plot unfolds, happens to be the brother of the princess.
Yeah, and all
so don't
ends,
worry, it
yeah,
all ends very happily. We don't get the brother and sister together.
Of course, the brother would love his sister because she's his sister.
Yes, exactly.
But then he can go back to loving
but
the
woman. But it's full of sort of intrigue and plots and everything that, you know, you're not quite sure which way anything is going to work out. And then magically, at the end, it's all revealed. Everything's fine, and we all end up with the right people. So that's a very quick.
Yes,
there's a lot more to it than that.
Very nicely done as well. Although a little bit over 30 seconds, I do have to reprimand you on that particular one. It's an old radio thing, you know. The character then, Alexander of Aristea. How romantic a princess is she?
Sure, I would say that she's quite romantic, quite passionate. Our director, Daisy, is actually helping me find a way to find another dimension to this character. Because in the realm of the opera, being a literal trophy wife, being the prize of these Olympic Games is not something that a modern woman is very used to playing. And so we're trying to find the multi-dimensionality of this character and how she is constrained by society, but how she's madly in love with this man, but she's not allowed to be with him, and how it comes to pass that she finds her way to him, he finds her way to her, and they are able to be together at the end of the games.
So, and I guess that is a challenge with operas like these, but it's there across lots of opera where perhaps
Absolutely.
The position of a woman is often defined in terms of whoever the big male character is in the opera itself. So I guess that's something that you constantly have to search for when you go singing opera in the 21st century.
Absolutely. I will say, 2 weeks ago, I was singing Carmen, and so she's a firecracker, and she's very much girl power, and anyone who gets in my way, get ready, because you're being stampeded. And so now to play this character,
Aristea,
I'm trying to find her fire, and I think her fire comes from her love, but also her sense of duty. She does have this responsibility. She was born of a certain society and with a certain pressure as a princess, a royal duty to be what she needs to be for her people. And how does she navigate that to be able to find what she wants as well, which, thank God, she gets at the end.
Good, okay. You're going over to the singing microphone now, and as you're doing that, Fergus, you might, Alexander's going to sing a section of an aria from the opera for us. Where are we at this point in the plot?
So at this point where Alexandra is with one of the other, the rejected woman, Argene, and the two women are together. The games have happened, but they don't know yet the results. So they're just sitting anxiously, and while she's sitting, she's singing about how her life is troubled and full of angst and problems. You know, she's waiting in hope, but there's a kind of a hopeful section and there's an angst section in it.
Well, we'll hear that now. And OJ Riven is there beside Alexandra on the keyboard. So let us hear the aria then from Vivaldi's L'Olimpiade.
Piangendo
Beautiful indeed. That was Alexander Urquiola with a section of one of Aristea's arias from the Valley Opera L'Olympiad. I'll give you a second just to get your breath. I'll go to Fergus. The use of the mezzo soprano voice, it's quite extraordinary from Vivaldi there. It's like, it kind of struck me as I was listening to it, it's like the slow movement from a Vivaldi concerto, that particular aria, because it brings it down into that slightly lower register, and beautiful big long legato lines.
Yeah, those phrases, which I mean are very similar to what Bellini and people like that were writing 100 years later.
Yeah.
It's that right out of that Italian tradition. It's so incredibly beautiful.
We're here saying how wonderful those big long legato lines are, but that's what you were talking about, Alexandra, in terms of those breaths. I mean, there was one of the words there where one of the phrases where it comes to an end, and then I don't know what the final syllable of the word was, but it's O, but there's about three little variations on that. I thought, is there a breath coming anywhere? So that's the challenge, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely.
It struck me too, listening to it, there are, you mentioned quite rightly, Fergus, this idea of bel canto, but I hear the beginnings of Mozart in there as well. There's that kind of delicacy that Mozart had. Vivaldi seems to be able to strike that too.
I would say that there are a lot of moments of real intimacy, and we can have that where you can't have that in something like the repertoire that comes later, the bel canto, the verismo, the opera seria that comes later. We don't have that opportunity as much. If you're going to do a piano, it needs to be extremely supported, and in any other repertoire, it's going to be a mezzo forte at best, because you need to be able to project over an orchestra. But because you have this orchestra with these period instruments, it's as if I am an instrument in that orchestra, and it's more of a collaboration instead of, here are my background instrumentalist.
And I guess that is part of that Baroque, the nature of Baroque
it's
opera.
It's a very different way of singing. Like, for example, we did Salome in the Bord Gosh Energy Theatre.
Yeah, so, huge force.
So in this one, we have a cast of seven, we have an orchestra of 10 or 12 musicians. So it's very, intimate, and for the audience, you're up close, you're very much closer to the singers, and you can sort of see, you can see the expression on their faces, you can hear the detail in their voices even more closely than you can in a bigger venue. So that's, I think, why, you know, it's very demanding to sing, because it has to be completely perfect.
You get that, that's reflected, that's a reflection in some ways of the sacred music of the period.
Absolutely,
as well, in that
yeah.
we might think of even things like the Bach Passion, and we might think of big choirs and big forces,
yes.
but in fact it was probably only one voice singing the soprano
Absolutely,
part,
yeah.
one
yeah.
voice singing
yeah, yeah.
the alto. So yeah. it was very much chamber music isn't quite right, but a much more intimate style of performance
it
that's
is,
involved.
Yeah. It is, and it's that up-close detail that you get as an audience member.
You're an opera singer. Of course you love the form that you've chosen to
yeah,
hand your
right.
life over to. But that initial introduction to opera, how did it happen for you? And was it love at first listen, or was it
yeah.
something else?
Yeah, you know, my mom's a therapist. She's a lovely woman. And I was quite a dramatic child. And I think my parents said, oh, we got to get an outlet for this energy. And I, you know, I'm from yeah. New York. And so they put me in the children's chorus at the Metropolitan Opera. And so
the children's chorus, beg your pardon.
At the yeah. Metropolitan Opera. And so my introduction to opera was on
yeah, that's kind of
one of the biggest
yeah.
stages in the world.
Yeah.
And I mean, I remember personally being in the Zeffirelli production of Carmen. And I think Denise Graves was my Carmen at the time. Really wonderful, wonderful production. And I remember coming to the edge of the stage at the end of the first course in Act One that the children sing. And the whole audience clapping and looking out into the audience and having the sensation of, if I could make this many people happy, I have a superpower that nobody else has. And I remember being stunned by this. And obviously that has developed into
yeah.
the fact that I'm in Ireland right now, a girl from, you know, the US. And before this, I was in Germany. And before that, I was in Spain. And I could travel around the world and I could speak to you and say to the audience, hey, this is what this character from hundreds of years ago was feeling. And I, as a 21st century woman, can compel you to relate to me in this role, and the music can bring me to you, and I can communicate with you in a way that otherwise I'd never be able to communicate with you.
Yeah.
And it's a level of empathy that I think nobody else has.
Thanks all three for coming into us this evening. Fergus Shiel, the artistic director of Irish National Opera, O.J. Riven, who provided us with the keyboard playing earlier on, and mezzo-soprano Alexander Orciola. Blackwater Valerie Opera Festival is set to take place across locations in Lismore, Yall, Dungarvan and Castlemartre. Among the repertoire to be performed is a production of George Frederick Handel's Giulio Cesare, which will be performed in the grounds of Lismore Castle in Waterford, with conductor Nicholas McGeegan leading the Irish Baroque Orchestra and a cast directed by Tom Creed, including in the cast mezzo-soprano Sharon Carty, who plays the part of Sesto. All three of them, I'm delighted to say, are with me in studio this evening here on Arena. The story of Caesar, I guess we'll all know it, probably, maybe we'll know it from our study of Shakespeare, or maybe we'll know it from Richard Burton and Elizabeth Taylor. But what is the story that's told in the opera here, Tom?
So, yeah, the Handel's Giulio Cesare is the story of Caesar and Cleopatra in the aftermath of the Roman Civil War, and during a civil war that's broken out in Egypt. So Pompeo, used to be Caesar's ally, has fled as a refugee with his family to Egypt. And Caesar has followed him. Pompey has looked for help from Ptolemaeo, who is one of two sister king and queens who are brother and sister but are married to each other.
Mm.
Ptolemaeo and his rival and sister Cleopatra. Ptolemaeo thinks that the way to get into Caesar's good books is to chop off Pompeo's head and send it to him.
Not a good move.
But that's a terrible idea, because Caesar is a man of principle and finds this behavior yeah. appalling. So the consequence of this is Pompeo's wife, Cornelia, and son, Sesto, are orphaned and are widowed and are refugees in this strange country. And while the characters try to reconstruct the country in the middle of a war, we discover that actually they're some of the most unsuitable people to be doing that. It's a bit like the characters from Succession have walked into contemporary geopolitics. In the middle of that, they fall in love with each other and betray each other.
You've got Succession into it, you've got love and betrayal into it, and you've got this idea of the refugee within it as well. It is obviously a modern story in many ways. Yes, it's the Roman Civil War, but it wouldn't take much to fit that into contemporary scenarios. What way are you presenting it in that regard? Is it in a period costume? Is it in a contemporary feel, or is it timeless in some ways?
I kind of like to think maybe that it's happening in the period and in the contemporary world at the same time. So we're playing the characters as modern characters. The costumes, you know, the tailoring is contemporary, but I would say there's a lot of acknowledgement of the Baroque in there. I've done a whole bunch of historical opera repertoire with business suits and mobile phones, and actually with this we're doing maybe something that's slightly different, something that's slightly more abstract, but something that can resonate with this extraordinary location where we're doing the opera. So we're, you know, we're in the yard at Lismore Castle, which has in it, you know, in itself also all kinds of history and a relationship between different countries.
Which is wonderful for a director to have that kind of mix of the ancient and the contemporary and all of those things in a potential setting. I wonder what it's like for a conductor to have to contend with the beautiful music of Handel and period instruments here, I think, from the Irish Baroque Orchestra.
That's
as
correct,
well.
Yes.
Nicholas, so they bring their own set of difficulties with them and their own sets of joys with them. And you're in an outdoor setting here, essentially. What challenges does that present to this music?
The challenge is the challenge that would have been the same in the 18th century and now, whether you're using modern instruments or not. They don't like being rained on. They don't like being baked. If you're doing something in the open air, you might suddenly decide that the local flora and fauna flying and not decide to join in. It's rather nice in this opera. We do actually have an aria with answering birdsong from a violin. Who knows, we may get the real thing.
You may get the real thing on the night.
The time is, shall we say, nightingale time, so we might get a real one. And that's very that's very beautiful, you know. It's performance, it's life.
Where does this Julius Caesar opera sit in terms of Handel's repertoire?
He came to London in 1710 and with opera. That company failed. And the chap who ran it was called Owen McSweeney, ran off to Venice with the money.
Is he an Irishman, Owen McSweeney?
I don't think he's Greek.
Okay.
And then he then went off to sell pictures back to rich English people from Venice. And so Handel then had a few years off opera. And 1720 was the Royal Academy was founded, which was the Royal Opera, as it were. And this opera is in 1724, so he'd been going for 4 years. Huge success, wonderful. He could, because of the royal backing, he could get fantastic cast. If you think of it as a modern Broadway show, this would be Lady Gaga, Ariana Grande, and Tony Bennett, in the same show.
Which are you, Sharon Carty?
That's the million-dollar question.
Oh, Lady Gaga, I think.
You are playing the character of Sesto, and this was actually written with a lady in mind.
Yes. Margherita Durastanti, who had sung for Handel longer than anybody. They met in Rome in 1708, so she was one of his pals.
So it is a male character. Was one of the first times that he had written specifically for the trouser role in this way?
No, I'm glad to say that castrati were always quite rare. Other castrati were very grateful for that, I'm sure. But it was considered cross-dressing was considered fine on stage as well. Ladies, of course, loved to play men's roles because it was the only chance they got to show off their legs.
Sharon, was that a major consideration the primary, in accepting this role?
The primary reason, I would say.
Because they'd be wearing, like a pantomime boy, wearing silk pants, as opposed to being a Georgian lady who would have basically dressed as a sofa. Yes.
Hence the trouser role of the title, the way it's put. The character of Sesto, he is the son who's quite angry, obviously, that his father has been killed.
Yeah, he goes on quite the journey throughout the opera. He starts as in quite a weak position in a lot of ways. And we were just talking about this during rehearsal, that as his arias develop during the opera, he garners courage and resolve and ends up ultimately, spoiler alert, killing the bad guy at the end. Mm. So he really kind of grows up. And that's kind of shown through his mother's eyes, that she really kind of sees him then as a worthy follower of his father, and she's kind of pleased with him.
What kind of music does he... I'm going to listen to your big aria in Act One. What kind of music does Handel give to the character of Sesto?
There's a lot of, I think, teenage rage and kind of, you know, which is understandable for a character who's seen his father's decapitated head been presented on, you know, on a kind of quite a political stage. So there's a lot of kind of building himself up and duty, and he feels honour bound to avenge his father's death. So that's a big part of the text of a lot of the arias. And then there's one moment of kind of calm in his second aria, Cara Spemi, where it's very reflective and he's kind of invoking the spirit of his father to.
But certainly in this Act One aria, you can give me the title if I'm giving a rough guide here, a guess here, as Svegliatevi nel cuore.
Almost Svegliatevi nel cuore.
Svegliatevi nel cuore. Which what or nel cuore? Beg your pardon. What is he singing about here?
He's talking about this annoyed. Awakening in his heart of the desire to the fury that's been awoken because of what's unfolded and what the path that lies before him.
Well, let's have a listen to that aria in a recording that features the aforementioned Nicholas McGeoghegan,
whom you will not hear at all because I'm conducting. Yeah. You can't hear me wave my arms around.
Yeah, well, you can wave them here. People can watch you on the live stream.
Yes, absolutely.
Svegliatevi nel cuore, the Act One aria of Sesto from Handel's Julius Caesar, as it will be sung by Sharon Carthy as part of the Blackwater Opera Festival. But I did mention before we went into that, Nicholas McGeoghegan, who will be conducting the performance in Lismore, that it was you conducting there as well. And you were telling us quite sadly that the person who was singing there died quite young.
Yes, her name was Lorraine Hunt Lieberson. That recording was made about 1990, and we made a lot of recordings together, and very sadly, in about 2006, she died of cancer in Santa Fe, New Mexico.
Yeah, and subsequent family tragedies.
Her sister had died a couple of years before, and then her husband died a couple of years after.
Very, very sad indeed, but lovely that you have that recording. Singing music like that to express what are very contemporary emotions, which in some ways feels like ancient music, does it feel ancient to you at all, Sharon, when singing it?
No, not at all. I think that's one of the amazing things about this sort of art, whether it's like, you know, you mentioned Shakespeare before, or, you know, an opera with a libretto that was written 300 or 400 years ago, whatever it is, that there's these universal human themes that are, you know, we haven't changed that much in the last 250 years, that everyone can relate to that. I think that's the brilliant thing about opera as well, that like it's not like going to the cinema to, you know, to rewatch the same movie. So with Nick and Tom and the cast that we have in Blackwater, it's going to be a really unique kind of melting pot of our take on it.
Of course, you had the misfortune to mention your PE teaching days in an article.
Did I?
In the newspaper. How useful is your PE background when it comes to performing this very athletic music?
Yeah, I mean, I would say I approach singing as an athletic activity.
It is
I guess.
Very physical activity.
And I suppose being sporty and kind of having been a bit of a tomboy as a kid makes the physicality of, you know, playing teenage boys quite fun. So, yeah.
Well, listen, I'll give people the details of it afterwards, but I just want to listen to perhaps a quieter, more reflective section. I think this is a Cleopatra aria, Nicholas, from later on, the scene three aria, Piangero la sorte mia.
That's right. She's ended up in jail by her brother, who put her in jail. And she says, you know, I will always lament my fate, and you can tell probably that her life is not going to be very long in jail. Because
she's not happy singing this.
She's not happy.
If Sesto was angry, this is the Piangere must be pains or...
I will weep. I shall weep for my weep. Dreadful
situation.
Future.
Yeah.
Which is not long.
Not long. Let's have a listen to that. Thanks so much for coming in. There she is singing of her a very short future ahead, the character of Cleopatra, which we were speaking about there with Nicholas McGeegan, Tom Creed and Sharon Carty. Operatic intensity is what comes to my mind when I hear Verdi's Requiem, and I'm sure it will thrill audiences in the contrasts between the very silent, powerful sections and the very dramatic other sections of the piece. Well, it's kind of a personification in music of Jaime Martín himself.
I love this piece, Verdi Requiem, but I didn't choose this piece to be the last concert of my 5 years here in Dublin. I mean, this is almost by chance that we are doing this. I mean, this was one of the pieces we were planning for a long time to do with the chorus, and we have such a fantastic group of singers that I somehow promised them sometime with the chorus master, let's do Verdi Requiem sometime. And actually, when we planned years ago to do this piece, we were not even thinking that this is the year I was going to stop. You know, then suddenly when I saw that, I thought, oh no, I mean, to finish with a Requiem sounds like it's not...
Kind of a death knell, yeah.
But somehow, you know, thinking, well, this is an amazing piece. And it will be a shame not to finish with orchestra plus the choruses. And come on.
Yeah, so let's do it.
But I have to say that this is not a reflection of how I feel.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just a celebration of music. Sometimes a Requiem could be a celebration. And for instance, in Mozart's Requiem, although it's about death. But sometimes there is an optimistic part about it.
And sometimes there's high drama, and certainly in this Verdi piece, there is high drama. I mean, yeah, it opens quietly enough, and things are gentle to start off with. But then, a little bit into the piece, we get this.
There we go. When you listen to that as you mimed playing the bass drum, which is kind of on the not on the main beat of the bar, it's kind of slightly off
the beat.
Do you reckon this could be a way of making money to get to give people the chance to play the bass drum as therapy? Because you really have to beat the lard out of it, don't you?
I was suggesting to one of the orchestras last time I did this piece was with the Melbourne Symphony Orchestra. And, you know, the bass drum, the player was having the time of his life, you know, bah, hitting the thing. And I remember I said to the orchestra, okay, maybe we should use this in our gala auctions, you know, to offer our donors to pay lots of money to come to rehearsal and hit the bass drum as loud as possible. Yeah, that would be quite a therapeutic exercise.
Yeah, and I guess what you could also do is put a face on the center of the bass drum of somebody that you are not happy about.
You can choose your own face.
You can choose the face to place on. But it does give us a sense that Dies Irae from the Verdi Requiem. I mean, Verdi was a great operatic composer.
You know, this is music that if you are a music lover, you enjoy. Mm. But actually, if you've never been to a concert before, or you just come to the concert hall and hear this, Dies Irae, and most of the music, you will be completely amazed and thrilled.
I'm going to go a bit further down into the work. And there are four soloists, as I said, a soprano and a mezzo-soprano, along with the chorus. The chorus have quite a big role to play in this as well. Rather like an opera in that respect, you know, and like a Verdi opera, you can hear all those great, you know, Va Pensiero from the book and all of these great choruses are there in the background. But if this were an opera, I'm going to suggest as people listen, we're going to listen to a version that has Angela Gheorghiu and Daniela Barcellona as the soprano and mezzo-soprano respectively in this version of the Recordare. But imagine that this was two people who were in love with the same man and give that operatic setting and it becomes something very different in my mind.
It could become something very different, but I think this is the power of music. And I think that's why I think, although this is called a Requiem, and it's called a Requiem, and it has the structure of the Requiem, but the music, for me, is not always a Requiem.
Let's have a listen to what I'm calling the jealousy scene from the Requiem.
Absolutely.
The Recordare from Verdi's Requiem. And of course, there is a sacred aspect too, because it is the words of the Mass that are being sung, of the Requiem Mass that are being sung there. But it has all of the intensity of a love or a jealousy duet,
absolutely,
doesn't it, Jaime?
And that's what brings this music alive all the time. And for everybody, maybe the text is in Latin, so most people don't. You don't really know what they are talking about very often. And actually, it's better not to.
Yeah, let it be what it is in your own imagination.
I think your music, I mean, very often I have to say that when operas, you know, since they put short titles in operas, for me it has been so disappointing very often. Because there is arias from operas that are so beautiful and I don't know what they were talking about. And now suddenly you know what they are talking about when you go to the opera. I love going to the opera. Mm. And in this most beautiful melody, basically they are saying, oh, please can you go and close the window because it's a little bit of draft. And they say, oh, what a shame, I thought they were talking about something. And sometimes the librettos of operas are
dubious.
Are a little bit silly, you know. I mean, not always, but but I think sometimes that you can take, yes, the music could mean something completely different for each person.
You've had 5 years, as I say, as chief conductor of the National Symphony Orchestra, and that tenure coming to an end now. When you came to the National Symphony Orchestra first, what did you want to achieve with the orchestra over your time here? What were your aims back then?
You know, the first time I came to the orchestra was in 2016. And I remember I did Shostakovich Symphony Number 11. And very soon after, I was asked to come back to do a Brahms piano quartet arranged by Schoenberg. And I was so happy working with the orchestra. I mean, I remember being outside the hotel the second time, waiting for rehearsals. And I remember, it's one of those things that usually you don't have to think, because if you think about it, then it will never happen. Mm. And I remember being outside the hotel thinking, wow, I really love this. I really like the orchestra. I like the city. So wouldn't this be a fantastic place? But this was at the time when I didn't know they were looking for somebody.
Yeah.
So it's one of those things. I would love something like this. And the reason, you know, when I was offered the job, I thought, wow, this is a fantastic opportunity. I mean, this is the only symphony orchestra in Dublin. I mean, there is
the
concert orchestra, and there is the opera. But I think in a city like Dublin, which is so amazing, and I think has an incredible musical tradition, and the people are so nice.
I know one of the first Mahler 3, that symphony, I think that was a big moment for you.
Yeah, that was the opening.
That was your opening concert as chief conductor. I remember one particular concert, which is kind of post-COVID. It was very shortly after post-COVID, and Anne-Sophie von Otter, in fact, you and she were in not this studio, but another studio, talking to me about that, and you played Titan, Mahler's first symphony. And I think it was very close to, it was one of the first performances that the orchestra, where there were no masks and there were no pieces of perspex blocking the brass, and it was open and back to, more or less, back to normal. I mean, I remember the feeling that, and it was the final night of a season as
It was
well.
Amazing. It was the final night or the first night? I don't know, the final.
It was
the final
night.
Night
of that season. Yeah.
I remember that concert so well, and I remember talking to you with Anne-Sophie. Anne-Sophie was one of my idols always, since I was a flute student and later on as a flute player in an orchestra or as a conductor. So to have her with us doing Schubert and then doing the Mahler Symphony Number 1 was an amazing moment.
How does she compare to Taylor Swift?
It's a different, you know, I'm sure she would love to jump up and down on the stage like Taylor Swift.
I remember when she came into studio, she was a rock star in my book, and Sophie von Otter.
I know about Taylor Swift, as we all know about Taylor Swift, but last week I was in Stockholm and I had two concerts with the Royal Stockholm Philharmonic with Janine Jansen as a soloist, a fantastic violin player. I had concerts Thursday and Saturday. And then Friday was my free day. And Friday, there was the first concert of Taylor Swift in Stockholm, the first of three concerts. Actually, so much that the airport in Stockholm says, "Welcome to Swiftholm," rather than Stockholm. The whole of Stockholm was sparkling and full of people about to go to the concert. And 1 hour before the concert, suddenly I thought, my wife came to Stockholm to see our concert on Saturday, and we had a free day, and suddenly she said, "Shall we try to go?" I said, "All right, let's look on the internet." Found two tickets, not very expensive actually, was okay. And I went to the concert. It was amazing. I think there is something about seeing 65,000 people, not just enjoying, but they knew every word. I didn't know a single word of these songs. But
and no subtitles.
No subtitles, but you didn't need it. I didn't need to know what she was talking about. Even the lady, four ladies from Boston sitting next to us, they had some kind of bracelets with that they all exchange with Swifty things. I have become a kind of semi-Swifty person, you know. And they gave me two bracelets, and I even bought a Taylor Swift T-shirt. that I am not wearing now.
I'm so disappointed you didn't wear it.
Oh, well, you know, nobody's perfect. I'll do it next time. But, you know, but for me to see Taylor Swift in life, I think it's wonderful. And I think it's what this is the experience that people have when they come to see a classical music concert. I think it's something about life, but could be life sports. Last month I was in LA with my son, came to visit me in LA. We went to see the Los Angeles Lakers basketball, NBA match. It was fantastic. But I don't know anything about basketball. I don't even know when to clap. But it's something about being in a place with people that are enjoying something that is happening now. And this is what makes live events for me very exciting.
Well, there you go. Jaime, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
We are here in Studio 8 with the freshly formed Allegria Quartet. They have bows poised and they're going to open our session with Grieg's first string quartet in G minor. And this is the opening section. Grieg's soaring first string quartet, played by Allegria Quartet, who are Lucia Murphy on violin, Ksenia Yershova on violin, Connor Galvin on viola, and Adam Joyce on cello. Connor, tell us how you four got together.
So we were first approached by Christopher Marwood, who was former cellist to the RT Vanbrugh String Quartet, and he just said, you know, would you be interested in playing with these other musicians? And I think we were all absolutely delighted when he, you know, proposed this idea.
And do you know the others, Ksenia and Lucia and Adam?
We all go back from National Youth Orchestra over the years. I know especially Lucia from, 5 years now?
Yeah.
Adam and Ksenia more recently. But yeah, that's where we all met.
And you're from Cork and you've learned and trained musically in Cork.
Absolutely, yeah. Through and through from, I was going to say from day one, but not completely, but we could say that.
And you, Lucia, you're from Limerick.
I am from Limerick, but in TY I started getting lessons in Cork School of Music as well. So, yeah, it's fantastic.
All right. And Adam, you're the baby of the group. You're not in... The others have completed their Leaving Cert.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah, I'm slightly younger. I'm heading into fifth year next year, but I'm definitely strongly leaning towards pursuing music anyway, just a bit later than these guys.
And you're the cellist.
Yes, I am, yeah.
And Ksenia, you were the other violinist along with Lucia.
Yeah.
So you are from Ukraine, and did you come here with your family?
We came here 2 years ago with my family, and I'm extremely happy to join Cork School of Music because it's an amazing place. And right now I just finished the first year in college, So it's an amazing opportunity to pursue my degree here in Ireland.
And you do some playing Ukrainian music with your sister.
Yeah, I'm an artistic director of our family quintet, and we play Ukrainian, classical and Irish music together. There's five girls of us, and we play all together music.
All right, and have you played here live and done gigs here in Ireland?
Yeah, quite a lot, actually. We were invited in a different concert. For example, the biggest one, it was for NSQF gala concert this year and the last summer as well. And we were happy to play on those amazing concerts with other musicians.
Fantastic. And Conor, tell us about that piece we've just heard, the Grieg piece.
Yeah.
Is that a difficult piece for a young quartet like yourselves?
Absolutely. I think we found it to be slightly more challenging, I think, than originally expected.
And were you happy with this choice, or did you say, Conor, what are you doing?
I think we all agree Grieg is a fantastic piece. It's incredibly challenging and also not as well known as a lot of string quartets, but it's really one of the best pieces of chamber music I've ever heard, and definitely my favorite piece I've ever played myself. So,
and how do you rehearse, Lucia?
When
you're in different places.
Yeah, so we normally go to Cork just because the school music, the facilities are great. Myself and Conor had the leaving cert, so obviously there's a bit of a gap while we were doing that. So, but yeah, normally when we do meet up, we do kind of an all-day situation just because it mightn't be that regular, but yeah.
All right. And is it just the four of you, or do you have some leader or somebody watching in and advising you?
At times, we've had coaching from Chris Marwood himself, and he's been really helpful for us and all. But a lot of rehearsing ourselves, and I think it's really good to sort of progress with our own ideas and kind of, you know, be creative. It's great.
Did you know when you knew each other in the orchestra that you might work together someday, or was
I think if you'd told me 5 years ago that I'd probably be stood here right now with, you know, everyone in this room, I probably would call you crazy, to be honest. But I'm happy that I'm here, honestly, you know, with everyone.
So, Conor, what's the next piece you're going to play? Some Mendelssohn.
So the next piece is Mendelssohn's Opus 44, number 2, string quartet in E minor. And it's a very nice kind of dark string quartet. It's towards the end of his string quartet cycle. I think we all really like this piece. We discovered the later movements more recently, and, you know, it's really fun to explore some, even that Grieg is more modern and stuff and more romantic, but even Mendelssohn is just, you know,
it's very dramatic, isn't it?
Yeah.
Well, let's listen to that now. This is the second movement of Mendelssohn's string quartet, Opus 44, number 2. That was the Allegria Quartet playing the second movement of Mendelssohn's string quartet, Opus 44, number 2.